welcome to the Lyricord Early Classical Music Podcast Show. And in this episode, we're going to start talking about the master of the Baroque, Mr. Johann Sebastian Bach. And that music you're hearing behind me is one of J.S. Bach's trio sonatas performed on two Lautenwerk, which are the gut-strung harpsichords performed by Sean Leppard and John Paul. And today we're going to talk about J.S. Bach as he appears on Lyricord discs on our early music series. And my co-host is Jeffrey Dooley. Hello, Jeffrey.
Hello, Nick. Good to be back again.
Great to have you back on this Bach exploration, and let's get on with the show. There are so many aspects to Bach that he really deserves his own space.
That's right. It's universal, really.
Right. Now, Bach was born in 1685 and died all the way in 1750, and he was the composer and organist of sacred and secular works for choir, orchestra, solo instruments throughout the Baroque period, and he never really went into the classical period, although his sons did.
His did, yes. He never, mm-hmm. he like Handel, never entered into the Gallant style, even though they both lived the same. Handel lived longer. He survived 1759.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting that Handel and Bach never did one piece in the Gallant style.
He would, right. Although they could have.
They could have, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. The closest, I guess, you'd ever say Bach is part is the trio sonata in the musical offering has a slight flavor of the Gallant style.
Mm-hmm. Well, what did you want to say to introduce Bach?
Just a few things, some interesting things about him. We tend to sort of think of Bach as something to be worshipped. And mm-hmm. And as a result of that, I think that one may have the wrong impression, because this was, of course, a great artist.
Mm-hmm.
But he was revered during his lifetime as an organist virtuoso. His music was considered a little bit old-fashioned, because this is comparatively late.
Mm-hmm.
So he was revered as a very learned, as it were, composer.
Right.
But he was mostly known for his organ playing and the great organ works, which are very improvisatory. The toccatas and fugues may have been improvised and later written down, but he would travel around and test organs, and that's what he was known for.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he write these elaborate pieces to really test the ability of organs to play fast, pedal parts that go fast.
Right.
So that was what he was known for. But he was also, he loved the inner part of harmony, and so he played the viola. He could play everything, but his setting of the text is magnificent,
mm-hmm.
and his ability to bring a very expressive emotional quality into a fugue.
Mm-hmm.
He literally made the fugue form, which in the lesser accomplished hands would be more of a form that you would follow. But he would actually create emotional expression in the fugue subjects that mm-hmm. he did. So here's this monument to music who did everything. He was a keyboard player, a great composer, organist, and he was even forward-looking in that his second wife, Anna Magdalena, appeared in the church, which was such a scandal.
Uh-huh.
And he used boys and men for his choirs. But the sort of worshipful state of Bach, I think, sometimes affects the performance.
Yeah.
One of the examples of that is that performers are very often reluctant to do any ornamentation in Bach. But it's important to remember that Bach is, after all, a Baroque composer working in a tradition of arias and sonatas that have the A-B-A form.
Mm-hmm.
So A is the first part, and then the B section would be a different movement, and then it returns to the A.
Mm-hmm.
So the performer would ornament a little bit.
Right.
But because Bach's writing is much more written out, performers tend to be reluctant to ornament.
Mm-hmm.
To me, and to other Baroque people who know the style, it's almost like doing a Xerox of the A section. So you add appositores, you add not as much as you would do in an Italian composer or Handel. So this is something that's really important. It's the next step of people to go ahead and ornament Bach's music.
Right.
That's from a performer's standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Also, he was a grumpy person. If you've ever read the new Bach Reader,
mm-hmm.
has more personal things in it.
Mm-hmm.
So how could a great person be anything but rather grumpy? You know,
right.
He was always complaining because he didn't have the forces.
Sure.
And so he was very demanding, but had a great sense of humor and irony.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorites, it's not a direct quote, but he was asked at one point how he could play these organs with such magnificence? And his answer was, well, you just press the right keys down at the right time, and everything comes out. So little things like that give you an idea. Also, he never wrote an opera. He did not compose one opera. The closest thing to an opera, really, would be the St. Matthew Passion, where you have characters. But for years, of course, most people know that his music languished in obscurity, except for the organ works, kept on being played by organists. But it was Mendelssohn who can be attributed with bringing his music back in his performance, first performance in almost 100 years of the St. Matthew Passion, sparked this new movement toward Bach. And Mendelssohn himself, the organ was his favorite instrument, and he was an organ virtuoso. So his own organ chorales and sonatas, very like Bach, contrapuntal, fugal. Anyway, so his first performance, he performed on the organ, the F major toccata and fugue, and the St. Matthew Passion, which started this incredible interest in Bach, and Albert Schweitzer, too, the great the great humanist, played Bach on the organ, and he felt that the organ should be a period instrument. And that goes along with the rise of the early music movement, is that the restoration of great organs in Europe, that return to the sounds that Bach would have heard. It's thrilling to hear his music played on these organs that we know he tested. So he was known as a player. So now we have this wonderful time where the instruments have been restored, and we can now hear Bach's music on those instruments, really the way Bach did it. Although he left very few registration instructions, composers really didn't do that. But people knew through tradition what the various organ registrations would be. So that's really how he survived the sort of miseries of the 19th century, where everything before the 19th century was considered cave music. But Bach was to be worshipped. So that was a negative thing for a while. You know, we would worship Bach, but, you know, well, you know, he's not really as expressive as Chopin. Or Chopin admired Bach very much. So his music just comes alive with period instruments. His music is revered for a very good reason, because he really culminated the whole Baroque movement. And he even was a great transposer. Bach adored Vivaldi's music and transposed quite a bit of his concertos from L'estro armonico for solo organ. He was very much aware of the Italian style. Vivaldi survived through Bach's transcriptions, but he transcribed even concertos for solo harpsichord as well as for organ. So he was so adventurous and was interested in everything. But the man traveled very little. You know, he really never moved away from Germany. And he had so many children, he probably couldn't leave them. And so, but he had his children, as you know, several of them became great composers, his sons, Carl Philipp and Wilhelm Friedman. Also, the other thing that I find so amazing about Bach is his music can cause such emotional reactions in people. Hearing certain Bach works, for example, in my own case, one of the greatest experiences of my life was, I'm old enough to have been in high school when John F. Kennedy was slaughtered. And this is in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where I lived. And the Fine Arts Quartet and the New York Woodwind Quartet were in residence at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. And they were going to be giving a concert that night. And they did an impromptu performance of the Art of Fugue. And that was the most overwhelming emotional effect of sitting there. I had never heard it before. I was still in high school. It was just incredible. It was one of the great moments. And people think of the Art of Fugue, all that structure, all that formality. The opposite was the case. People were openly moved. They had to take a break because the oboe player was weeping and couldn't play. It was one of those moments in my life I'll never forget. The St. Matthew Passion, that it is so overwhelming for the performer as well. You can't do a St. Matthew Passion and sort of be laid back professional. Of course, you have to be professional enough that you don't break down, because if a singer does that, no sound comes out. But this happens very often with these works. So you can imagine what it must have been in Mendelssohn's day when this was performed for the first time.
Well, the other thing about Bach, he was enormously prolific.
Yeah.
And now, didn't he write a cantata a week?
Yes. That was part of his position in Leipzig.
I just can't understand.
Isn't that amazing?
One of these works per week.
It's just amazing. But, you know, composers like Telemann is the other unbelievably prolific composer. They composed the way we would write a letter. It was all done in the head. And look at Beethoven. He couldn't hear anything, but he still composed these works.
Right.
And also, he was a smart person. He borrowed from other works. He reused other works with new texts, maybe some new instrumentation. Mm-hmm. But it is a sign of the genius that he could not only produce these every week, but each piece is full of symbolism.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And look at pieces like the Brandenburg Concertos. Mm-hmm. You know, he wrote those to impress.
Yeah.
And they're amazing. They're completely unique in the whole output.
Right. Well, speaking of Bach's music, thought we'd start with Cantata number 10 from our recording on the Lyric Orderly Music series. Nigel Rogers is the tenor, and Sally Lesage is the soprano, Shirley Minty is alto, Neil Howlett is bass soloist. And these are performances with the London Bach Society and the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Paul Steinitz. And it was actually recorded by Michael and Lawrence Meacock for their Oryx label, and was licensed to Lyricord back then.
Uh-huh.
Now, this was recorded actually in the 1960s, which is not a particularly historically informed decade, I suppose, for the
That's
Baroque.
That's true.
But this is a rather interesting recording because, either by accident or intentionally, it was rather small chorus and a rather small orchestra.
Yes.
Pretty much in the scale of Bach's orchestra at the time that he wrote it.
We would sort of say it's inadvertently historically informed.
Right.
Doesn't that sound great?
And this recording featuring Nigel Rogers, who was just a wonderful vocalist.
Yes, the singers on this recording later became members of the historically informed performance style, especially Nigel Rogers, who went on to literally recreate the Italian technique of ribattuta di Goggia, which is the rubitations in the throat, the articulation of the throat.
Mm-hmm.
And Shirley Minty was in the Deller Consort for a while. Mm-hmm. And the soprano, Sally Lesage, yes, she also went on in the English early music movement. She, too, was in the Deller Consort.
Mm-hmm.
So these people were all gathered together. And Paul Steinitz, who has the Bach Society, he says in his recording, this was not some, remember, this is 1965,
yes, right.
So this is not some musical logical attempt to make Bach sound the way he sounded. We just thought it would be very lovely to do it this way.
Right.
So what he was doing was reduce forces, and what you hear, modern instruments nonetheless, is clarity, wonderful clarity.
Right. Well, let's listen to the chorus and maybe also the recitative by Nigel Rogers from Cantata number 10. Thank you.
seinem Arm an denen, welche weder kalt noch warm im Glauben und im Lieben sein. Die nacket, los und blind, die voller Stolz und Hoffart sind, will seine Hand wie Spreu zerstreuen, wie Spreu zerstreuen.
We snuck an extra one in on you there. That was the duet with alto and tenor. Nigel Rogers is the tenor, and Shirley Minty was the alto. Really gorgeous recording there.
Wonderful, and this is an example of Bach using the chorale melody held in long notes, which you heard in the oboe, held in long notes, and this would be called a chorale prelude, mm-hmm. And it even is. He even used it as a chorale prelude for organ.
Uh-huh.
And he used quite a few of his cantata movements as chorale preludes for organ. I'm not sure which came first, the chorale prelude or the cantata solos.
Mm-hmm.
This one is one of the ones that he used several times. There's even an organ version of a solo organ version of it.
Uh-huh.
But the interesting thing about the recitative that you all just heard, usually recitative, even with the organ, we know now that the organ was not held through all the recitative
right.
parts. A chord was touched, and the singer would then sing between them,
mm-hmm.
and it was sort of the effect was that, as it traces back to when continual accompaniment was invented in the early 1600s, as accompanying oneself on the lyre. They all thought they were going back to the Greece, which was the whole thing of the late Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
So composers like Monteverdi and Caccini and Cavalli all used the continual accompaniment. So it's supposed to be accompanying oneself on the instrument.
Mm-hmm.
So the effect should be a chord played and then secco. That's why the term secco as opposed to accompagnato.
Mm-hmm.
A secco recitative means that, secco means dry.
Mm-hmm.
So it means that you would just touch the chord and come away. Right. And the voice would continue sort of unaccompanied until the next chord change. But Bach would mix together the accompagnato style and the secco style. So what you heard, it sounds like it could have been an accompagnato because the chords are being held all the way through.
Right.
But I've sung it, and I know it is only continual. But you'll notice at the end that it becomes rhythmic, a little arioso section, and the bass line begins to move. So at that point, then, it becomes arioso. Arioso means the bass line is moving, like a little arietta or aria style. But in general, the secco accompaniment is chords played short. The singer sings through them. The accompagnato recitative is just what it sounds like, accompanied, the accompanied recitative.
Right.
The person who brought this to its greatest fruition was Handel. And that's an orchestral recitative that has rhythmic sections in between, and then the voice sings unaccompanied between these instrumental outbursts, and it can be tremendously effective, and it went all through the opera.
Right.
In all the operas, they all have what we now call accompagnato recitative. But Bach uses the chords. Interesting about Bach, too, like is typical of Bach, he writes out very carefully where he wants the silence to be made. He'll have rests.
Right.
And especially the end of the recitative, you always hear this bum, bum, the tonic and dominant at the end. Bach specifically writes a quarter rest there, so that dominant tonic chord is afterward. What tends to happen, that influenced other performers, and so a secco recitative became too final, because after it finishes, you hear always hear bum, bum. But it shouldn't be that way every time. The only time you would really do that is if you wanted to, for an effect. Although Bach marks in all of his music, which is always interesting, there's always that quarter rest there.
Right.
So he didn't want what we'd call a double dissonance. In true secco accompaniment, the singer, the first note of his ending, da, da, dum, pa, the dominant is under ba, ta. The singer has the da, da, and then the dominant is played. So there's a second of dissonance there. And that means that it's going to go on.
Right.
So in opera, where you have a lot of recitatives, or in Handel oratorios, where you have all these recitatives, you don't do what we call delayed cadences, except at the end, and sometimes not even then. But Bach is very specific about it. So you always do it in Bach, because that's the way he wrote
it.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
So this is an interesting combination. Yeah. It gives the impression of both accompagnato and secco.
Very interesting.
Yes.
Well, let's take a break, and then we can come back and play some more, okay?
Very good.
Lyricord presents one of the finest sopranos in the world today, Elizabeth Futrelle, in her first solo recording of Bach's solo cantatas. Mary Singer of Opera News declares that she is blessed with a shapely coloratura soprano and a rare combination of vocal and dramatic ability. Edward Rothstein of the New York Times calls Futrelle's singing refined and accurate, hitting her high notes without strain or artifice, giving her vocal acrobatics warmth without ever succumbing to egoism. Stephen Eddins, All Music Guide, review of this recording praises Futrelle's warm, colorful voice that's at its best in the music's broadly lyrical passages and in the recitatives, which she brings excitingly to life with supple expressiveness, while conductor J. Riley Lewis leads the Washington Bach Concert, a period instrument ensemble in bright, lively performances with a good sense of presence. Be sure to add this sublime Lyricord recording to your download or CD collection by visiting www.lyricord.com today.
I'm back here talking with Jeffrey Dooley on the Lyricord Early and Classical Music Podcast. Well, now let's move on to cantata number 47, and we'll just play one piece. A beautiful soprano continuo aria by Sally Lesage.
And the interesting thing about this aria is it's a continuo obbligato right hand, obbligato organ, mm-hmm. which is unusual. Probably Bach played it himself. I can easily imagine Bach playing it.
Uh-huh.
And the little boy standing there in the loft singing the aria, because he used boys and men.
Right.
Although Sally is one of the great sopranos. She was the favorite in the Della Consort. So this is interesting because the organ is playing the accompaniment, but there's also a cello playing the bass notes.
Yes.
So this one is quite pictorial. So I'd like to, it's in A-B form. It doesn't have a da capo. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to give the text because you'll notice the short notes in the B section. Mm-hmm. It has to do with the meaning. And there, whenever he does an accompanied an arioso or an accompanied keyboard instrument aria, it's always full of meaning in the accompaniment, in the right hand. So the first part of it is, I'll give you the translation, he who would be called the Christian, and this is literal translation, was really good.
Mm-hmm.
He who would be called the true Christian must to meekness give much practice. Meekness comes from Jesus' realm. Then the section is really quite articulate, and this is a little bit more foreboding. Haughty pride is devil's fare. God treats all those with his hatred who their perils do not abandon.
Hmm.
So here the accompaniment is quite almost not staccato, but very emphasized.
Mm-hmm.
The right hand part is moving along. And he often uses this as a symbol of the devil's work.
Mm.
Cantata 170, which is an alto cantata, which I've sung, is full of it's for solo organ and strings and mm-hmm. two oboes d'amore. It's full of elaborate right-hand movement whenever he discusses anything about the devil. So he's using something unusual for the time. Most composers didn't write obbligato organ parts.
Uh-huh.
But Bach's an organ virtuoso, so he's going to write something that
right.
he's going to play.
All right. Well, let's hear from cantata number 47, the soprano continuo aria. And what is the name of it, Jeffrey?
It's called Wer an Vater Christ will heißen, muss die Demut sich befalben, which is, he who would be called true Christian must to meekness give much practice.
Good.
Thank you. Wonderful.
That was quite beautiful. Now, I'd like to move on to another instrument. Bach wrote for lute as well. He wrote for just about every instrument.
Yes, he did. He wrote every instrument. Every instrument that existed, he wrote for.
The album we're going to play a couple of tracks from is Jerry Willard Plays, Four Centuries of Lute and Guitar, the great lutenist and guitarist Jerry Willard, who has done a number of projects with Lyricord. So we'd like to hear the prelude from Suite Number 1, and then we'll hear the very famous Boré.
Thank you.
First, we heard the Prelude and Presto from Suite No. 1, BWV 996, and then the famous Bore, both by Jerry Willard on Arch Lute. Wonderful recording in which he covers four centuries of guitar and lute and Baroque guitar and modern guitar music. Anything you want to say about that, Jeffrey?
Yes. Bach wrote quite a bit for lute, not as much as for other instruments, but some of his cello pieces have been transposed by other performers for lute, and they work very well. Probably the greatest lutenist of the time was Weiss, Leopold Weiss, or Weiss, who lived at the same time, and Bach did know of him. I don't myself know if he composed his lute pieces for him. It's a possibility. But he wrote for the lute the way he wrote for some of the slow movements in the harpsichord. Mm-hmm. So these work very well on the harpsichord or the mm-hmm. keyboard. For the famous Bore at the end is one of the Bores that we all learn when we're learning keyboard,
right?
These lute Bores. But the interesting thing is using an arc lute here, and the arc lute is a large Baroque lute in that it has more strings and it has more bass sound. It's not as large as a Theorbo or a Kitarone, but it's considered more the Baroque lute. It was mm-hmm. used for lute solos.
Well, thank you for being with us today. That about wraps it up.
Oh, great to be here. Looking forward to more.
Yes, we'll see you next time.
All right.
This program copyright 2010, Lyricord Discs. All rights reserved.